The 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
Not only in HIV/AIDS, but those of us in particular who are focused on the epidemic as it affects children. So I'm very pleased to welcome you here to our satellite session on the prevention of mother-to-child transmission. I know that many of us share the same set of goals and aspirations that in our lifetime we will see all of the moms treated who need to be treated around the world, and to see the infection rates among children virtually disappear as they have in the developed world. I'd like to take just a moment to thank Johnson & Johnson, and as I was just saying, a company that has supported our work in the prevention of mother-to-child transmission now in sites around the world. We are indeed very grateful for the support of Johnson & Johnson, and Johnson & Johnson has helped us in supporting this session today, and we're very grateful. I'd particularly like to thank Sharon D'Agostino, who's with us today from Johnson & Johnson, and Anu Gupta, and I know you're here with a few other colleagues. But we are indeed very grateful for your support, and we're particularly delighted to have you with us today and over the next few days. Let me just talk briefly in introducing the session about the work of the Foundation. As I think many of you know, we established our first programs in prevention of mother-to-child in about 2000, the year 2000. So over these past 6 years, we have been very active in bringing those programs to developing countries around the world. At this time, we're working in 18 countries, and we've reached over 2 million women with PMTCT services. At the same time as we sit here today, and we will hear many people over this next week, talk about the challenges that lie ahead. At the very least, we understand that we are only reaching 9% of the women who need the services in prevention of mother-to-child transmission. Only 9% of those. So the challenge is, what about the other 91%? And you'll certainly hear today from a panel of experts that I'm indeed very proud to stand among today, what we believe not only the challenges are, but what are the lessons learned from the work that we've been doing over these many years, and what is the way ahead for all of us. So let me, without further ado, let me please introduce my colleague. It is a great pleasure for me to introduce my colleague, Dr. Kathy Wilford, who is our scientific director at the Foundation for PMTCT.
Thank you, Pam, and welcome to everybody in the room. I think my days are getting confused. Good afternoon, I think. May I just remind everybody something that is probably first and foremost in your thoughts. It is 25 years since HIV was described, and it is the 16th international conference. I hope everybody in this room that has participated in the programs to prevent mother-to-child transmission takes great pride in the effectiveness of this intervention. I think that the studies that have demonstrated our ability to decrease transmission to children rank among the highest, if not the highest and most important studies that have been done in the past 25 years. A sobering note, we do have the knowledge to diminish transmission. In the developed world where we can apply our information, the transmission rates have been reduced to 1 to 2%. So the problems that face us, every one of us in this room, are how do we accomplish this in the developing world? Yes, we could use assistance with more drugs, yes, but in fact, it's not the paucity of drugs that is stopping us from reducing transmission in a more effective fashion. WHO released new guidelines today on the appropriate regimens for prevention of mother-to-child transmission. They have encouraged folks to be brave and to consider an array of drugs that might enhance prevention of transmission. We are all supportive conceptually within the realm of feasibility. And there's a balancing act between how well can we do and how many women can we reach with an intervention. If, in fact, we're only reaching 10%, it seems like an incredibly important goal must be to expand the number of women who have access to services. I'm going to present some information today which deals primarily with the nevirapine regimen, because I think that we can enhance the delivery of services in those places and programs that are focused on nevirapine or choose nevirapine to use. So my presentation will be very focused, and I am clearly in support of how we might advance these regimens. The Thai program presented in the WHO session today that they had succeeded in instituting AZT from earlier in pregnancy in the third trimester and had so substantively reduced transmission rates when they add nevirapine that is in the same realm as the triple therapy or heart programs that are proposed to be applied or more complex regimens. And clearly, if we could add AZT, we would do well. And I think Elizabeth Stringer is going to speak specifically to some of those issues. Now, I'd like to acknowledge folks who have contributed to all this work, the entire foundation staff, both in the United States and, most importantly of all, in all of the countries where this work goes on, as well as our partners in countries who are not EGPAF staff but are responsible for the programs. It's important for me to personally thank the people that we are trying to serve with these programs. And I want to specifically acknowledge Allison Spensley and Tabitha Saripapatana, who really should be up here talking because they dug out this information and have contributed in such a substantial way to the programs. I want also to say, because I'm going to show some photographs, that the photographs were taken with express permission of the people in the photographs, and I do not want that to be construed as anything about their HIV status. So here we go, and let us look at first at the EGPAF programs. These are the 18 countries in which we currently have programs. They are heavily concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa, clearly commensurate with the burden of disease. That is, we have proportionally more programs in sub-Saharan Africa than we do in other locations, and I do not want to diminish the importance of the programs in Asia and Russia and elsewhere. Here are the cumulative numbers for women who have had access to the services which we support. This is through December of 2005, and we will soon have another 6 months worth of services to add to this. So that the provision of services by all of you and many who are not in the room have reached over 2 million women. I think it's astonishing that cumulatively 90% of women seen in these programs have been counseled and that more than 80% have actually been tested. And what you can't see from this slide, and I will show you later, is the difference between the first years of the program and the last years of the program. So that when you start programs, at least in the early years, it is the case that the outcomes were often not the same or were not as good, in quotes, as we think that they are now. So I'm anxious to show you that some simple measures have been able to improve the uptake of the simplest regimen. In all of the countries in which we serve, the average seroprevalence is on the order of 10%. Part of the reason that it is that low is because we are providing services in countries with low seroprevalence. So in sub-Saharan Africa in particular, where people know full well the prevalence rates, they are higher than 10%, obviously. And we heard this morning, and I think on other occasions, specifically about South Africa. If you look at the later part of the cascade, you will see that it is continuing to be the weakest part of the provision of services. That is, knowing that the mother and or the baby actually get the intervention in their hands. It doesn't speak to whether they swallowed it. It speaks to the fact that they actually got the pill. And that's the first step, obviously, but I don't want it to be misconstrued. Here are the countries in which we work in Africa. Here are the cumulative totals, if you will, and outcomes from the African countries. And it is clear that 180,000 of the women who were HIV infected were identified in the African countries. This is a Tanzanian mom and her baby. For me, they're just so lovely, I can't bear not to share them with the rest of the world. I'm going to speak briefly about Professor T's program in Cameroon. He's sitting here in the front row, and you will get to hear from him directly. Raise your hand. Yes, thank you. And I'm also going to formally introduce him. Don't worry about that. From 2001 to 2005 in their program, which has expanded so that it now encompasses some 41,000 women a year, since the beginning, this program has provided routine counseling and opt-out testing. And in this program, a lot of education is provided initially, and then the woman has an individual pre-test counseling session and gets to make a decision about whether she will or she won't be tested. I think this is one of the finest documentations of our ability to reach people with the opt-out approach to testing. Something which we tend to take for granted in the developing world is same-day testing results, because rapid tests are making the extension of PMTCT programs possible. That is, in the days of the ELISA, it is clear that that all by itself was a potential inhibition to programs and or contributed to the delay in receiving results. So in Shabisa, South Africa, when the program began, in fact, 66% of women received their results after they were tested. And that's because the test had to be sent to another location and returned a week later, and the women may or may not have returned to clinic to get their results. So although they agreed to be tested, there was a logistics problem in terms of taking advantage of the results. When it became possible to do rapid testing and the counselors were trained to do rapid testing, more than 90% of women got their results on the same day and subsequently, and often on the same day, received their nevirapine dose. In the Dominican Republic, the same kind of increase, although not to the same extent, has occurred. Remember that the Dominican Republic is a low seroprevalence country, and the seroprevalence is such that the number of women tested is disproportionately larger than in a higher seroprevalence country. Now I want to try to make a point about reaching the estimated HIV women in the population. These are real numbers, but I won't identify the countries. In the first country, 49,000 women were seen in antenatal clinic, but because of not 100% counseling and not 100% testing, if you used the defined seroprevalence in the population to determine how many HIV-positive women were among the 49,000 women in antenatal clinic, only 25% of the estimated HIV-positive women were actually getting their intervention. In country B, the reasons why the differences in the cascades were slightly different, but 32% of moms got their antiretroviral drug. So the point of this, and I'm going to show you a specific example in a moment, is that each time you drop, if 1,000 women come to antenatal clinic, but 900 are counseled, you've just dropped out some HIV-positive women who won't have the opportunity to be tested. If only 10% of the 900 are tested, you've just lost the vast majority. If you don't give drug to the women who are HIV-positive, you just keep losing women with each step of the cascade. So, I'm sorry, this doesn't show up in this light, but all of us Westerners wish we had learned how to carry our babies on our backs. We would have probably been much more comfortable in many different settings. And my daughter has learned, and I didn't teach her, but she's much happier now that she can actually do that. In the Malawi PMTCT program, in a year when they saw 20,000 women in the clinics where the services were provided, they could only counsel 75%. They were understaffed. There was a huge number of women in antenatal clinic for first visits on any specific day. One would say they certainly were successful in their counseling, as 100% of the women who were counseled were tested, and the seroprevalence rate was 15%. But only half of the women got their dose of nevirapine because they needed to come back to get the dose. And a year in the year that followed, when a number of changes were put into place, which included group pretest counseling so that they could counsel 8 or 12 women at once, it included the opt-out approach to testing, and they gave the mothers nevirapine at the time that the diagnosis was made. With those relatively simple changes in the procedures in clinics, the number of estimated HIV-positive women getting their nevirapine went from 33% to 96% in the space of a year. That's a remarkable accomplishment, and it isn't changing anything except the patient flow and the approach to the patients with routine services, hopefully, and I think in this case, integrated well into the antenatal care package. When we look across our countries, and please recognize that we do not have national figures for countries. We have the figures based upon the clinics where we provide the services. And therefore, I do not want to represent erroneously national statistics for any country. You'll see the variability. You'll see that some places reach essentially all of the women with the dose of prophylaxis, but most places are not succeeding in doing that. And so while we think about the more complex regimens, let us remember that the simplest regimen of all is a little difficult to deliver in some settings. This is a community education phenomenon, and what I particularly like is that there are both children and there are several men listening to this in Chitungwiza. Dr. Mahomba is smiling. She recognized, I think, the nevirapine support groups that were working there. I think it's important also to think about the timing of the dose. I've already implied that if women don't get it when they come to clinic and have their diagnosis made, that it may be a lost opportunity and they don't come back to deliver in the hospital and therefore they don't get their medicine. Well, here are situations in four countries, and the policy by the Minister of Health in Uganda and Tanzania was that you could only give out nevirapine after 28 weeks gestation. So according to the information which is gathered in those settings, roughly two-thirds of women actually got their dose of nevirapine. In a setting in Kericho, Kenya, and in Cameroon, where policy changes were put in place, at least the provision of nevirapine and the access to it by the mother changed substantially in a short period of time so that the first missed opportunity is gone. Now the question is, does the mom actually take the medicine or not? An additional area I think that we can all work on, which is also stated in the new WHO guidelines, includes the offering of counseling and testing in maternity. So we began these services in antenatal clinics, and we are very much interested and expect to provide comparable services in maternity, that is, during labor and delivery, for the women who come and whose serostatus is unknown. And we would go so far as to ask that people think about using the valuable personnel who have been trained to provide those services throughout the MCH, whether it's in family planning, whether it's in postnatal care, or whether it's even in well-child clinic, because the baby and the mother will come together to well-child clinic, and there's another opportunity to ascertain the status and to begin to provide care for an HIV-exposed baby and an HIV-positive mom. The infant uptake of medication is the weakest link, and this is largely related to the fact that the drug has not been provided in a single dose package, so that it is dispensed from a bottle within the framework of maternity if the mother comes to deliver in the hospital setting. It is indeed practical, and I think it's been established by the group in Uganda, that you can successfully dispense the infant dose of nevirapine in an oral syringe. The oral syringes are now provided as part of the donation program for dispensing of the medication, so that it is not an added cost, but there is labor involved in placing the medication into the syringe. These are results indicating the increased enhanced uptake of nevirapine when this infant syringe is provided. And I think as we consider the more complex regimens, remember that they all involve something in addition to AZT for babies. And the reluctance of policymakers to support mothers taking medicine home means that we might accidentally exclude those babies who are delivered at home but whose mother's status is known. If you look at our statistics, I said I would refer to this later in the presentation, and ask the question, sure, the numbers have increased a lot. Have we significantly increased uptake of counseling and testing and the administration of antiretrovirals to moms and babies? Yes, indeed we have. So I think that it's important to appreciate, first of all, not just that we keep records, but that all of the sites where the services are available, that records be kept so people can ascertain if there are weaknesses in the program and how to enhance the delivery of the programs with time. So in a quick summary, I think, not quite sure where that comes on, routine counseling, opt-out testing, rapid testing, counseling and testing in all points of contact in the MCH, giving the medication at the time of diagnosis, and the take-home infant medication, I think, will enhance programs greatly while we figure out how to enhance them further with the addition of more complex regimens. And so with that, I'm going to end my presentation, and I think that we're going to hold questions till the end of the panel because we're intending to have some 45 minutes worth of discussion at the end. So thank you so much for your attention. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Samuel. Dr. Samuel's been working hard already at this conference. He's spoken at least once or twice since I've been here in the last day or two. He's a professor at the Tamil Nadu University in India. He's well known to most folks for organizing not only the international conferences on HIV in India, but he provides care for children and has indeed over the years been a pioneer in his country in initiating PMTCT programs in a rural sector, as well as doing it within the framework of the public programs in India. And Dr. Samuel, thank you so much for joining us, and please, we're anxious to learn from you.
Madam President, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to be with you this afternoon, and I thank the Elizabeth Glazier Pediatric AIDS Foundation, who have been supporting us with our programs in India since 2000. Actually, it was at a meeting, I think early 2001, when I was presenting some preliminary data in Italy, and I saw Dr. Kathy Wilfred sitting there, and after the meeting she came and said, "Who supports you?" I said, "Nobody." So, and then she went back to her country, and then they gave us an award, an interim scientific award, for us to keep going with our program. And now we have started. This is not a government. I work in the medical university, and we have set this program up in a rural district of Namakkal, which is 300 kilometers from Chennai, and we use the government hospital setup to run these programs. And the program is sponsored by the EGPF, and therefore I will walk you through some of these my slides. As you can see that, well, you know that India, with its 1 billion population, presents many contradictions, bringing hope and, how do I go back? And we in India, we have lots of old diseases, with nutrition, malnutrition, other infectious diseases. And now it's not a new disease, but HIV/AIDS in several parts of India is still looked upon as a new disease. And as early as 1997, we observed that HIV infection in India was clustered. But nobody would take us or believe us that when we said it was clustered. And our understanding of the HIV epidemic now is much better than it was in early 90s. And in 1994 onwards, we thought, after the 076 studies were announced, we were in the medical university and we wanted to ensure that our medical student looked upon taking HIV/AIDS as a carrier to be involved and working with HIV/AIDS. But at that point, when you looked at HIV/AIDS, it was always death. There were no therapy. And then 076 came in, we went up to our administrators and said, can we get involved with mother-to-child transmission? So the first things we did was to do some seroprevalence in our major hospitals in India. And then some of the GPs called us from this district in Namakkal, which is largely inhabited by long-distance truck drivers, and said, we are seeing lots of patients here. Would you come and help us? That's how we got ourselves involved in this district. And since 2000, a rural program to prevent mother-to-child transmission has been initiated. And people like to know, why Namakkal? And, you know, India, we're very comfortable to know that it's only 1% of people who are infected when you take the whole country. But then UNAIDS tells us that we should look at these small epidemics occurring in the country. And if you take India, as you see, the national prevalence is 1%. But you can see Namakkal is up to 6%, and then in the northeast and northwest and some of the parts of western parts of India, there are far higher than 1%. So it is important that we, who are in the resource-limited settings, when we have limited amount of resources, we should be looking at these clusters and putting our money into those areas. And the history of the MTCT program is the first rural PMTTC program in the country. HIV education program was offered to the community. VCTCs, now we have introduced VCTCs in our existing MTCT centers. And we encourage a lot of private practitioners to offer care and support to HIV/AIDS. This is probably the only district in my state, and I could say in whole of South India, where private practitioners actually handle HIV/AIDS patients. Unfortunately, they don't send the data how many of them they handle, and therefore our data is still fractured. What are the services we offer? We offer HIV counseling, group counseling when they come to the clinic, and then individual counseling. After the informed consents, we do testing, and then those who are positive are offered individual confidential counseling. But at the same time, informed consents is something which we need to look at. Informed consents, we were involved in a study with NIH and long regimen, and the informed consent was 17 pages, even after it's been translated. So what are these informed consents when we are talking about rural populations? How much of it they understand, and how much of it can they really understand in terms when they do have some side effects? Antiretroviral prophylaxis, we have offered different regimens at different points, but the standard of care now is 2-dose nevirapine. And how do we get to women who are in these rural settings, and if they become pregnant, how can we reach them to offer these services? And the current statistics of our program are, as you can see, about majority of the people who come to our clinic stay, and they want to be tested, and they participate in counseling, informed consent, testing, and around 2%, 2-3% of people are positive. And our loss to follow-up is 17%, which is high. And another thing we are finding at this point in time is we're finding a lot of discordant couples. Men probably, who even if they're on long-distance truck drivers, they have probably protecting themselves by using condom, and they are negative. But you see, it's not the same situation when it comes to their wives or their partners. So the future is we are intending to spend more time with how to ensure that these women who are positive while their husbands are negative, and how do we provide care and support and counseling. This is going to be a major challenge for us in the next couple of years. What are the follow-up? 76% of the women do come to our clinic, and the follow-ups is increased when we offer opportunistic infection medicines, and we also have team of people who go and visit them at home. And home-based care. This is very important when we talk about rural areas. It is not it's not right that we think about clients coming only to the clinics, but those who don't come. And also, one-time counseling is not on. We need to continuously provide counseling. So therefore, we have a team of committed individuals who have been working with us for the last 7 years, and they continue to provide this care and support to women at home. And our coverage, in spite of all these investment, is only around 32%. Even if you take 50% as the target, we are not yet reaching them. And the development of partnerships are with different groups in different parts of the world. And this is the NICHD study we did. And there are problems. You know, just now Kathy was talking in terms of long regimens to be offered. We have offered long regimen as a study, as a research protocol in one program. And in another program, we are offering 2-dose nevirapine. When we offer long regimen, it is such an effort. We are even providing incentives, providing travel. We still have people who default, who don't come in on time, unless they're visited. So when we are thinking about long regimens in the resource-limited care settings, we must be very careful. I'm sure that those of you who are in this room are committed to mother-to-child transmission to reduce it. Therefore, I urge you, let us see that it increases from 9% to at least 30-40% by these two-dose nevirapine before we think in terms of going into taking up long regimen. And what has been our impact? As I've said, 32% of pregnant women in our district are covered. We have been able to organize a community participatory advisory board in which most of the people are part of it. But again, this is another challenge in a developing country. Who are the leaders? In a country like India, with a lot of our caste systems, who is the representative? Who represents a particular caste? Therefore, we need to be very careful when we call people into these so-called community advisory boards. And another impact has been we do, since it's an academic institution, DNA PCR tests, and now we offer that service to the whole country, to the whole state. And more spouses, more couples are now attending our community program, and we go often and reach outreach to the community as much as possible. So one of the impact has been 2.8% of positive people in the beginning of our program, and now we are still 1.25, and it is still, we hope that in the years to come, it'll come down. So because we have developed an excellent infrastructure with mother-to-child transmission, the government of India has come up and said, you will be the first center to have to administer antiretroviral therapy from a rural setting. This was the first thing. Now there are more centers are being sort of established, but this is the first center. And therefore, as you can see, that there is an eligibility criteria, and which is similar to what probably others are using in the rest of the world. And till now, around about 1,400 people have been through this antiretroviral three-drug regimen, and they are receiving three-drug regimens. And we try and see, wherever possible, to push our women and children into this program. And that's the regimens which have been used. Adherence is excellent. Adherence. I mean, you know, and I think this is, we are still in the first year, you know, second year, and we need to see what happens in the years to come. So that's on antiretroviral therapy. I think, is that all? Oh, it's not moving. Sorry, Alice.
Technical assistance, please.
So what have been our challenges? The challenges is always the long distances where the clients have to walk in or come by bus, and also the transport facilities. And we must remember, in our developing world, it's the woman who wear the bra. They are the pillars of our homes. And therefore, they have to work. They have to probably look after the husband, send the children to school. And therefore, if you say you come tomorrow to the clinic or you come a week later, it is going to be very difficult for them to come, particularly when we don't provide any facilities for them. And also stigma and discrimination. It is still rampant. Stigma and discrimination by the community, stigma and discrimination by our own healthcare professionals. Because people who work with HIV/AIDS have to squeeze their stigma and discrimination before they actually serve HIV/AIDS patients. You know, I used to work with leprosy some years ago. It was a similar situation. We have to evolve. We have to progress to take our own, squeeze out our own stigma and discrimination before we look into HIV/AIDS people, particularly children. And now we have set up MTCT. On that, we set up antiretroviral therapy. Now we are working to develop a pediatric unit. And we have residents come from University of Washington periodically, and they help us with setting up and working with the children. And this picture shows you that how, you know, there has been a lot of discussion that children, toxic side effects, how can we give antiretroviral drugs? And I can tell you on the field, except for one or two, majority of them, remember, we are still breaking the tablets and adding and giving it, but it's not a big issue. And 30% of our HIV children are in need of treatment. Antiretroviral therapy is helping many of these children to live a normal and healthy life and go to school. And what is it, what have we done which made the difference? And the difference has been doing a clinic on a Saturday, because Saturdays are not, government hospitals normally don't work, but we set up a clinic on Saturday so the mothers and children could come. And we do a lot of training. And again, I must compliment Elizabeth Glazier, Pediatric AIDS Foundation. They support us in our training programs. Training programs of the village health nurses, training programs of the local doctors, training programs of the medical students, and now training programs for pediatricians, how to handle pediatric management of HIV/AIDS. And now we would like to, we have brought the MTCT services from the city to a district level, and now we want to go down to up to primary healthcare center. And the research which we had, where we used three drugs, we hope we could slowly, in a phased manner, introduce in other good sites where we have excellent adherence for nevirapine dose. And in conclusion, what I like this slide because in India, we are going through this phase of, yes, ART for children, very for antiretroviral prophylaxis was very important. We set it up, and now we are into that thing, oh, yes, it's working. And you know it's not working. And it's, again, the policymakers. Policymakers have to be careful. When they introduce antiretroviral therapy, tomorrow it could be microbicides, it could be vaccine, you must see that those programs which are existing have to keep going. And then you develop another strategy for and another group of people to handle antiretroviral therapy. So, and I think this is very important when we work in developing countries. So I think with that, I would say thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Professor Samuel. We are so privileged to have people with this array of experience talking to us today. So I hope you will all take advantage of the opportunity to ask questions if we finish as we're supposed to, allowing adequate time to do that. The next speaker is Professor Pius T. from Cameroon. Professor T. Began in the beginning with the program in just several facilities, and I'm not quite sure the final number, but I think the number of facilities in which the programs exist, I know it's over 200, and I'm guessing 232. And he's smiling, so maybe I guessed right. At any rate, those programs are fully incorporated into the MCH clinics. He has expanded programs and won't talk about this today, but has before, about orphans. He's developed training programs for traditional birth attendants, and all of that while maintaining this incredible uptake that I described to you in counseling and testing. Finally, I'd like to say that they have earned a number of awards, including being designated by the regional office of USAID to be a training center, and de facto they've become the training center for all of Cameroon and have provided training to a large number of people throughout the region. So Professor T, please come share your wisdom with us, and thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. First and foremost, I want to bring some acknowledgments. I want to, first of all, thank Elizabeth Glacier Pediatric AIDS Foundation for choosing us in West Africa to be one of the pioneer sites for PMTCT way back in 2000. I want also to thank especially the experts that were working with them, Kathy and her team. They brought us lots of hope at a time when we did not know anything about PMTCT, and they actually visited us, helped us to start this program. I want to thank her in particular for braving it through to the most remote part of Cameroon to see us and to get this program started. I want also to thank Columbia University that has recently come in to help us. We'll be talking today about treatment linkages and so on. Columbia is already in with us. I want to thank them for that. I want also to thank Tom and Eddie Welty, who actually were like our consultants and worked with us to put this program in place. And Dennis and Nancy Palmer, they are here with me. He's seated right there. He's actually the one who is leading in the treatment and care at this point in time. So we are glad. I want also to thank our program staff back in Cameroon and the rest of our supporters for what we have today in Cameroon, which has extended to the region, as Kathy said, the whole of West African region. And I'm thanking AWARE for picking us out as the best practice that can be replicated. Sometimes many people do many good things, but they are not seen. So we are fortunate to have been picked as the best practice in that region. You don't doubt where Cameroon is. At least you have heard about football. If you have not heard anything good about Cameroon, at least you have heard about the soccer. They are a soccer nation. At least we are good in one thing. And maybe you can look at the position there. I put that up just to tell you our seroprevalence rate is around 5.5 in the general population. And that follows a general survey which was done in 2004. And among the pregnant women, it still staggers around between 8 and 11.4%. And again, most women are infected than men. And this is not only in Cameroon, but everywhere else. Those are the only highlights I want to give to you on this. The context where we work is we are a faith-based organization, and we seek to provide care to all who need it as an expression of Christian love. And we have been doing this since 1937 in 3 hospitals, 23 health facilities, and 40 primary health centers. Kathy just mentioned that we are already using TBAs to deliver PMTCT. It is in the settings of these primary health centers, which I talk of, 40 of them there. We started there, but now we are doing it in other settings in rural villages. The background of this is that we have been working in the communities for long, and we observed an increase in the HIV infections in some of the hospitals that we had in rural areas among the population that we were serving. But we didn't know what to do until we had a visitor who said, well, there's something we can do. Maybe we should introduce PMTCT in our maternities to prevent the vertical transmission from mother to child. And so in 2000, we initiated PMTCT with the first grant from Elizabeth Glacier. At the time, we did not actually have good trained persons to help us with the work, but at least we were able to do this on a smaller scale to begin. And we had encouragement from Uganda that was already doing this at the time. So we said we may also do it. It's like we were the second country on the continent of Africa at the time. And there were no treatment centers in Cameroon at all. There were actually no other places where we could refer to for what we were doing at the time. And again, even ARVs were not being heard of at the time in the country. We started small, and we started growing, and now we are in 6 of the 10 provinces in Cameroon. You know, the population is about 16 million, and we have 10 provinces. We are in 6 of those 10 provinces, and we actually provide PMTCT in over 200 facilities, and we have covered as many as probably 232 sites, to be more precise. And over 90% of the women that come to our clinics accept to be tested. That is, our acceptance rate is pretty high. And the reason for this is the group facilitated discussion that we make. When they come in, we counsel them. We don't counsel them. We do what we call group facilitated discussion. That is, we give them the full information as a group. And later on, we proceed into individual counseling in their room, very similar to what Dr. Samuel said here. And from 2005 to 2006, we've been able to counsel out of 72,000 women, and of whom 5,000 of them are positive. But only 350, which represents 6.4%, have been enrolled in care and treatment through MTCT Plus Colombia. Let me say something here. We look at PMTCT as the entering site, but an entering point into treatment and care. But when we had Colombia come, they had some restrictions as to who can be initiated into treatment. They don't accept anyone who enrolled in PMTCT more than 18 months. So if you enrolled in 2000, you cannot be accepted into treatment and care. So that has actually limited the number of people that we can accept into treatment and care in Cameroon. All the same, the rest of the people who have not been enrolled through Colombia, this program which is offered by Colombia, we are still able to see them in the other treatment centers that are not actually sponsored by Columbia University. The process, as I started telling you, routine visit of ANC clients at the first visit. We make sure everybody that comes in the first visit, we give counseling, we tell them all of what will happen, including the possibilities of being enrolled into the treatment and care center at the end of the period. So the women know right from the beginning that they are not only probably going to receive nevirapine if they were positive and go home, they will be enrolled into continuous care from when they are positive until when they give birth, and even after, they will continue to be followed by the staff in our clinics. Communication for behavioral change is one of the things that we do on a continuous basis for most of them. Because, I mean, the acceptance of the disease is one thing, and the idea of not spreading it is also the other that we try to emphasize. Treatment of positive mothers and their infants with single-dose nevirapine. I don't need to repeat this because all of us, we've heard and we know that this is what we are using. This is the regimen that we are using up to now, because we work in remote areas where even if we wanted to give the dose as from 28 weeks and ask people to go to, you cannot be very sure that they are going to follow through and be able to take and so on. So we are keeping to the single dose nevirapine since it is simple, and we are sure that at least the mothers can remember to take either when they come in, I will give them at the first visit, or even if we give them later, we are sure that is simpler than the short course or even the long regimen which Dr. Samuel alluded to. It may be more effective, but in a rural setting, we cannot actually go for that yet. Counseling on infant feeding is very important. We have trained counselors in infant feeding, and we try to emphasize that. We also say you can go ahead and breastfeed up to 6 months, and then you wean abruptly. We also say for those who will not, who would like to stop and actually not breastfeed at all, this is what you have to do. We have counseling on replacement feeding for such mothers. So we have nutrition counselors that have been trained in this domain. And then referral to MTCT Plus, or the treatment center, is done almost immediately. They come in. We'll try to make them know where they can go to at the time when they shall have delivered. Then follow-up of infants up to age 2. We try to follow them up. Again, follow-up is not very easy. I'm sure in India and other parts of Africa, it's the same thing. Sometimes they are lost to follow-up. Lost to follow-up with you is 17%. Ours is maybe a little higher. But we do not, we have not documented the exact percentage of those that we are not able to follow up. But it is pretty high. Most of them who delivered, we cannot actually trace. Addresses are not exact. We don't know where to actually get them. But we have trained adherent counselors as well as just health educators, volunteers, to be able to go out and try to follow up and see if we can track down most of the babies and the mothers if they are still alive, and then we can get them followed up. We have started what we call support groups of all infected mothers, and as soon as they test positive, we always make sure we refer them to a support group. And support groups have proven to be very effective in keeping track of all the women that have passed through our program. We can reach them easily if they are in support groups. But if they just go, you don't know where they are, you don't know what is happening to them, whether they are well or not, we don't know. And I'm sure it is an effective way of keeping the women in the program at all times if they belong to a registered support group. When we started in 2000, as I said, there were no treatment centers. And In 2002, we had 16 authorized treatment centers. That is in the whole country, in all the 10 provinces by the government. And in 2006, there are already so many treatment centers all over the country. The problem here is the price of antiretroviral therapy was very high and remains high even now. We may say it has dropped from $1,000 to $6, between $6 and $13. But how many people can pay in the community? How many people can come up with $6 per month to pay for that treatment? So this is a difficult thing that we find. And we know the Global Fund has actually given enough money to countries in developing the world to reduce treatment for these mothers and their children. But how much of this is actually going into the drugs is quite another story. We don't know much about it. But at least we appreciate the fact that the prices have been dropping and that the mothers can have the drugs a little cheaper than. We, as a convention, we have 3 treatment centers, and we hope we will increase 2 more in the next year ahead of us. Because when we talk of linking these mothers to treatment centers, where are those treatment centers? They are mostly in the cities. They are not in the villages where the bulk of our services are. But when we open more, we'll reduce distances for most of these mothers, and they will be able to enroll in treatment and care. Treatment and care for us is family care. It involves the woman who is positive, the husband, and the rest of the family. We look at the whole family. We are not looking just at that particular lady who is walking in through your ANC and who is positive. So if it is a whole family, you want to have this as close to them as possible. Many government and private treatment centers are there, but they do not have the funding to provide the services the way they will expect them. The difficulties, again, we cannot do PCRs. I'm glad, you mentioned this in your university, you can do PCR, probably because you are an institution of higher learning and so on. But with us, it is very expensive having these machines to be able to do this. And sometimes, if we have to do it, we'll have to send it out of our environment to the national capital, and it is very, very expensive to do this. And again, CD4 counts, we have to do this. It is required in the treatment center, but it is expensive. We have long distances even to do CD4 count. But in our 2 hospitals, 3 hospitals, we have CD4 counters already, but we don't have a PCR machine. From the beginning, I said PMTCT is an entry point. Again, I don't want to repeat this because I mentioned to you, as soon as we diagnose a woman positive in the ANC, she's referred to the MTCT Plus clinic. The MTCT Plus is a lifelong family-centered care for the entire family. Our workers visit them in their homes to ensure that they are doing fine and that they continue to come back and so on. Our support groups, we make sure that most of them are tested every 6 months to see their conditions and to see if they are actually following up the treatment. We give them cotrimoxazole prophylaxis and both to them and the infants, as well as vitamins. And we try to even refer them to other treatment centers if need be for them to come on full treatment. This is our support group members from January to June 2006. That's January 2005 to June 2006. This is what we have been doing in the treatment centers where we are. We have 80 males enrolled, and of the 80, 45 are on treatment. Female, 350, as you saw from the beginning. These 350 are from PMTCT. Out of the 5,000 and something that are positive, these 350 have been enrolled for follow-up, and 99 of them are already on ARVs, And pediatrics, we have 225 that have enrolled, and of these, 12 of them are on ARVs. And this number of this 225 actually includes both HIV-exposed children and those that are infected, that are already HIV-infected. And then the total, you can see the total, the support group members are 1,050, and 895 of them are already on ARVs. Again, the support group members include both men and women out of the total of 2,245 that we have enrolled in our support group groups for follow-up. The reason you have only 895 on treatment is just what I said. There are some, well, they have met the treatment criteria anyway in order to be put. But the rest of them are being followed up because from the day you enroll, they follow you up to be sure you are doing fine. And I think that is so far what we are able to do. For referral and follow-up, there are problems. When you refer them to go to treatment centers, they don't go on time. They may remain at home for quite some time and until you follow up again. And then treatment centers do not make counter-referrals. I don't know whether you've noticed this for those of you who work on this. Those you refer, they either delay or even when they go, the treatment centers do not inform the PMTCT sites that they have received these women and this is their condition, this is how it is going. There's not much communication between the two. So information exchange between PMTCT sites and the treatment sites is not very good and we need to improve on this. And then only 350 out of 5,000 positive mothers that have been identified have enrolled in the treatment center. And then there are delays in PCR results. We used to send our PCR, dry blood spots to Atlanta, and we'll wait for results for quite some time before they will come. Now we may send to Yaounde, pay much higher, and receive them after a short time. But whenever they delay in Atlanta, the parents and the health care providers don't feel comfortable. They don't feel happy because they don't know the results of what they are doing. So this is a little bit of delay in our service. Treatment overshadows PMTCT because most often it's the treatment component that is really solicited. We want to be on treatment and not just PMTCT, PMTCT, and so on. So I think that is a... We have complementary activities, community AIDS education, youth network for abstinent tuberculosis, orphan care, support groups, and prevention of malaria in pregnancy. These are some of the support activities that we have. Some of our challenges, as I said, when we started, they were not skilled laborers, the healthcare workers, and the implementation plan was not in place. We had difficulties in mobilizing national support. But with a meeting that was held in 2002, where Kati was and some of the people from ECPAV were able to make the national leaders to support what we were doing, and it actually worked out very well, and we developed the PMTCT policy together with the Ministry of Health. And so there were no treatment centers, and the cost of supplies were high, and you can see what we tried to do as a means of solving this. The key thing there is that we started from the grassroots, small, and we grew with time. And this helped us a lot. We used a single-dose nevirapine prophylaxis instead of going into a more complicated regimen. And now it is easy to link what we have been doing on to treatment because Columbia University also came in and gave some financial support to help with the treatment sites. Now, just... In conclusion, we know that we have done a lot to get PMTCT services started in Cameroon. And with the leadership award that we also received from Elizabeth Glacier, we're able to do a lot of training of healthcare workers at the national level to scale up services in Cameroon. It has led us into a position where AWARE, which is Action for West African Region, selected us to be able to expand this to the West African region. We cannot remain there. We know there's still a lot to be done. And so we want to thank all the supporters of this program and to say there is still much to be done. With additional financial support, we can do more, both in Cameroon and in the West African region. Thank you so much. God bless you.
Thank you very much, Professor T. And you've laid down the challenge for Dr. Stringer, our next speaker, because you indicated some of the things that it's very difficult to do in linking mothers to care. Dr. Stringer lives in Lusaka, Zambia, and she and the team there have provided PMTCT for the entire district of Lusaka. And they've built programs to provide therapy for persons with HIV infection who need treatment. I know my numbers are out of date because they were through March, but the treatment program had enrolled over 47,000 people in Lusaka. We've spoken about the linkages, we've spoken about the difficulties, and I don't think there's anyone with more experience in trying to solve those problems. Elizabeth.
Good afternoon. So what I'm going to be talking about today is our experience in Lusaka taking care of pregnant women who are identified with HIV. Okay. So where I live in Lusaka is the capital of Zambia. There are approximately 2 million inhabitants. It's very densely populated. In the government health system, there are 24 government private primary health clinics where women get their antenatal care and where ARVs are delivered. In 11 of those centers also deliver patients. These same 11 delivery centers are also providing antiretroviral therapy. There's one referral hospital in Lusaka. It's called the University Teaching Hospital. And within Lusaka, within those 11 delivery centers, there are about 45,000 deliveries a year or more. In Lusaka, there's very high HIV prevalence among pregnant women. It's roughly 22%. That translates into over 1,000 pregnant women being identified with HIV every single month, which is a huge number. This prevalence has not dramatically changed over the past several years. And from data that we have from MPCD Plus and now the treatment program, about 20% of pregnant women within Lusaka are in immediate need of ART based on their CD4 count and their WHO stage. As Kathy said, ART services began in 4 government clinics in April 2004 and was expanded to 10 more centers over a period of 18 months. Now, one of the things that we're working very hard to do in Lusaka is to get the pregnant women who need heart on heart. And a question is, why is that important? One of the main reasons that's very important is that the pregnant women who are sicker are the ones that are more likely to transmit HIV to their infants. So it's by getting these women on heart, we can prevent more perinatal HIV transmission. We can also prevent more orphans. The average Zambian woman has over 5 children. And if we can get these women started on heart, then we can prevent orphans, which is very important. And also, it's cost-effective if you look at the burden of pediatric HIV on the community as well as all of the orphans. So in preparing for this talk, we thought about what are the main issues in Lusaka that we're dealing with in treating pregnant women. And we outlined 5 important issues. One of the biggest issues that seems simple but isn't is identifying the pregnant women who actually need heart and getting them enrolled into ART. Another issue is deciding when to start therapy in these women. Another one is dealing with the complexities of care for pregnant HIV-infected women. It can oftentimes be much more complicated than a non-pregnant woman. There are lack of detailed guidelines regarding treating pregnant women, and also there's a heavy burden of malaria and tuberculosis in this population. Two other issues are training healthcare workers in the complexities of taking care of pregnant women, and I'm going to talk about this later. But most of the care that is given to pregnant women within Lusaka is by nurse practitioners. Nurse midwives, sorry. And most of the HIV care is provided by clinical officers who are like physician's assistants. So that's causing, you know, some issues with training of the healthcare workers. And then the last issue is actually educating pregnant women and their communities on the benefits of ART. So what it boils down to is that within Lusaka even, many pregnant women are not being evaluated for ART, even though there is a very large treatment program that is free of charge and labs such as CD4 count are free. So, and there are many reasons that pregnant women are not being evaluated for heart, but one of them is that the antenatal clinic is separate from the ART clinic. Now in Lusaka, we're fortunate because it's within the same health center. They're not in separate, you know, like miles apart, but they're still at different parts of the clinic. So when a woman is at ANC and she may wait 2 to 4 hours for her antenatal appointment and then she's identified as being HIV infected, she doesn't want to go wait in a very long line at the ART clinic. Another issue is that I suspect is that in the antenatal clinic, all of the women are pregnant, but you don't see very many pregnant women in the ARV clinic. And so I think there's an additional amount of stigma with a pregnant woman going to the ARV clinic. Women often fall through the cracks. We know that we have problems with women following up for PMTCT and bringing their babies back for even single-dose nevirapine, and the same issues are there with long-term follow-up with HIV care and treatment. And as I was saying before, the nurses in MCH who are actually doing most of the prenatal care, they're not trained to give HIV care. They're not trained in staging, and they're not really allowed to prescribe antiretrovirals. So that's a whole other issue that we're having to look at. So we, in Lusaka, in the beginning, pregnant women, once they were determined to be HIV infected, they were given a slip that said, refer to the HIV clinic. So we decided to look at how successful this method was. So between December 2004 to June 2005, we looked at 9 clinics where pregnant women were given a referral slip. So of 1,935 pregnant women, 321 were enrolled into long-term care, and 59 of those 321 women were started on heart. We estimated, based on the 20% of women needing heart, that approximately 15% of eligible women were reached, and that's a total of 3% of the total HIV-infected women were started on heart. At the same time we were doing this, we decided, well, this doesn't seem to be that effective. Why don't we try a different model? Why don't we do reflex CD4 testing? And so in 2 clinics, reflex CD4 count was implemented. In this model, pregnant women, the day they learn their HIV status, their CD4 count is drawn. I'm sure this happens in, you know, many countries, and it seems simple, but it's a little more complicated than it seems. So they now have their CD4 count drawn, and it's sent. And then the next time they come back for their antenatal visit, their CD4 count is determined, and then they can be immediately referred over and fast-tracked into the ARV clinic if they need heart then. Using this model, 188 pregnant women were enrolled into care, and that's at 2 clinics, so that's why the numbers are smaller than the previous slide. 26 women were started on heart, and if we estimate that all of those 20% probably needed heart, 32% of the eligible women were reached, which still, with that model, twice as many women were started on heart, although the numbers are still very, very small, and there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. And our experience from MPCD Plus, which Professor T talked about, we've had MPCD Plus in Lusaka for several years, and it's a separate clinic that was set up pretty much just for pregnant women to receive treatment and their families. So of the women that we asked in the clinics, only about 40% of the women agreed to go into MPCD Plus. And of those, 20% qualified for heart. The good thing from MPCD Plus is once the women were on heart, we kept them. We retained them very well. But the problem is that we had a separate doctor, we had separate nurses, we had a lot of separate staff running MPCD Plus. So I think that the ideal situation between simply referring women and then having this robust model of MBCD Plus is going to be somewhere in between that. We don't know exactly how it's going to be, but somewhere in there I think is going to be the best. Now, WHO recommends that pregnant women who need ART for their own benefit should be started on it, and otherwise they should be given some combination of antiretroviral prophylaxis. Now, if we, let's say we were to start all pregnant women on ART in Lusaka, there would be many, many problems. Currently, the Zambian guidelines for initiating pregnant women, they're the same as non-pregnant women. It's been thrown around, maybe we should, you know, increase the threshold for the CD4 count, but right now it remains at 200. And the goal of the Lusaka district is to identify pregnant women who need ART and start ART immediately, and then for the other 80% who don't qualify for ART, to give combination AZT and nevirapine. And it's believed that with this model, we can dramatically reduce PMDCT, although this is, you know, more complicated than just doing it in a day. So that's the ultimate goal with the reflux CD4 count. Now, the problems with starting all women on ART, especially in Lusaka, would be, you know, the potential nevirapine hepatotoxicity in women with CD4 counts greater than 250. Is that a real risk? And also the logistics and burden on the healthcare system, as I stated. In Lusaka, this would be an additional 11,000 women getting heart every year. And then when, if we started them in pregnancy, when would we stop them? And then the cost. It's complicated treating pregnant women because of the host of drugs and how they interact with pregnant women, and then there are a lot of issues that we don't even understand very well. But we do know that there is teratogenicity with some antiretrovirals, such as efavirenz, especially in the first trimester. But the bad thing is that the data are often ambiguous regarding toxicities in pregnant women and fetal outcomes, which can be confusing to healthcare providers. Is there an increased nevirapine toxicity with a CD4 count greater than 250? This is relevant, especially now, with our pregnant women who have a stage 3 and a CD4 count of 350. Are there unique toxicities with protease inhibitors, such as, and then the ART predisposition to adverse neonatal outcomes? These are all issues that the healthcare providers in Lusaka are dealing with. Now, training healthcare workers to treat pregnant women is in the forefront, and there's ongoing education for providers regarding pregnant women and special needs. Development of separate guidelines have had to occur because of the differences. And then another hurdle has been instilling a sense of urgency with initiating ART. In the general training for providers in Lusaka, providers are taught it is not an emergency to start anyone on ART. But when you have a pregnant woman, your mind shift needs to change a little bit because we need to get the pregnant woman on heart as fast as possible to prevent more babies from getting HIV. So this is, instilling that urgency can be a huge hurdle. But as providers treat more pregnant women, and as I said, the clinical officers are not really used to treating pregnant women, they treat non-pregnant women, they get more experience and, you know, and they get more ease with treating patients. And also, as infant testing in the form of PCR becomes more available, there will be a direct benefit that the providers can see when babies are prevented from getting HIV. Another issue that comes up in training healthcare providers are issues with malaria and tuberculosis. Both of these are endemic in Zambia, and HIV-infected women are more severely affected with malaria. When you think about the drugs that a pregnant woman may be taking, if she's taking heart and if she's taking septum prophylaxis, she may be receiving that in the ART clinic. Well, then she goes over to the to get her antenatal care, and she may or may not tell them that she's on heart. And then she's going to get IPT for malaria, for prevention against malaria. So the pregnant woman can be getting lots of different drugs that may predispose her to lots of different toxicities. More and more in Zambia, we're facing issues with tuberculosis. Pregnant women are coming in their first trimester who need ART and who have tuberculosis, and so that presents specific challenges with what drugs to put these pregnant women on. And then lastly, communicating to patients that pregnant women can receive ART, that is another huge hurdle because oftentimes pregnant women don't know that they can take heart, and the communities don't know that pregnant women can take heart. Another issue is that pregnant women feel healthy. And so they may not even think they need to be evaluated for heart. There are also issues where they may not want to take their medicines because they don't discuss it with their partner due to fear of abuse or abandonment. If they're found to be HIV positive and taking medications, it's harder to hide taking heart than a single dose of nevirapine. They may not understand the dramatic reduction in transmission taking heart. And also, oftentimes, women have very poor social support and limited social services available. So we looked at a cohort of women who were pregnant from the Lusaka district and then who were non-pregnant. And as you can see, the CD4 counts were much higher in pregnant women who were coming in for care. And also the WHO stages were dramatically different. If you look here, you can see that most of the pregnant women were stage 1 or stage 2, whereas most women in the general population who were non-pregnant were stage 2 or stage 3. So they were sicker, and there was more of a sense of urgency for them to seek care, actually. So in conclusion, a major barrier to treating pregnant women with ART is actually getting them enrolled into care, identifying them and then getting them to go to the clinic. Making care easy to access for pregnant women who generally feel well is critical, and the Lusaka district is doing this with reflex CD4 count. Ideally, nurses in MCH would be able to take care of these patients, I think, so they wouldn't be shuttled between clinics. Our goal is to strengthen reflex CD4 count, the reflex CD4 count model, through the use of peer educators. At two clinics within Lusaka, we're now using peer educators to link up with pregnant women so they can navigate them through the ARV services and also follow up their babies to make sure that they're tested after delivery. And we're very fortunate in Lusaka to have an electronic medical record. In the general ARV program, there is an electronic medical record. And in the antenatal care, there is an electronic medical record. So we're now working to integrate those to better monitor whether HIV-positive women are enrolling into care and if they're coming back for care and if they're getting started on treatment. And this poses a particular problem because in Lusaka, most of the records that women carry in a lot of places in Africa are handheld records, and they take them with them. So it's very hard to tabulate what is actually happening to women, especially when they're going, you know, from MCH over to the ARV clinic and then linking that care up. And then finally, more information is needed to guide appropriate management of pregnant HIV-infected women, particularly with regard to pharmacokinetic data on ARV drug levels in pregnant and nursing mothers in diverse populations, including Zambia. And scaling up heart in pregnant women is urgent for both moms and babies. Thank you very much. And I'd like to acknowledge the Glaser Foundation, my friend and colleague, Dr. Moses Sinkala, who's sitting in the front row. He is the head of the Lusaka District Health Management Board. And none of this would have been possible without his perseverance towards preventing, you know, mother-child transmission of HIV. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. And I'm going to ask that when the next speaker concludes, that the panel come up here and we will begin to address the questions. There is, in fact, a microphone in the back. The next speaker is Dr. Agnes Mahomva from Zimbabwe, who has just finished being the National PMTCT Technical Advisor for the Ministry of Health. She's done a fabulous job leading a team in a national program that has extended, I think, far more or farther, is a greater national program than many countries have been able to manage. In addition to that, they certainly were amongst the first to appreciate the real problems of identifying the infants who are exposed to HIV-positive moms. And in the spirit of integration within the health system as one small part of the things that she did, she's going to tell us about the identification and follow-up of HIV-exposed children. Agnes.
Thank you very much, Kathy, and it's a great pleasure to be in front of this audience. I am going to talk about identification and follow-up of HIV-exposed children, and specifically looking at the Zimbabwe experience. And to do that, I'll give you a quick background. I'll look at the Zimbabwe PMTCT program summary very briefly, as we actually have several posters on the details of our program at this conference. I'll look at main challenges in identification and follow-up of HIV-exposed children. And then, of course, I'll try and look at the addressing the identification and follow-up challenges, summarize and give you a conclusion. And, of course, I would like to acknowledge several organizations that have actually helped us with this particular program. Just to remind you, you saw a lot of figures that Kathy was actually showing about HIV prevalence throughout the various places that ECPAF is actually supporting. Zimbabwe HIV prevalence continues to be very high, 20.1 in the adult population, 21.3 in the ANC attendees. And of course, if you're looking at the estimated HIV infections among children 0 to 14, you know that it's 40,000 in 2003 and about 30,000 in 2005. This is all figures from our national ANC survey as well as our estimates statistics. But I would like to just say, in order for us to appreciate the importance of identification and follow-up of HIV-exposed children, it is very important for us to remind ourselves that the main goal of PMTCT programs, whether it's in Zimbabwe or anywhere else, is to protect babies from HIV-related infant morbidity and mortality. Very, very important indeed. And of course, to do that, we also need to remind ourselves that it is very important to do that in the context of the four-pronged approach. In other words, looking at a comprehensive program strategy, which includes primary prevention, prevention of unintended pregnancies, prevention of MTCT, as well as, of course, the provision of care, follow-up, and psychosocial support of the mothers, babies, and quite clearly the families, because it's not good enough to just look at the baby itself. Certainly, four-pronged approach that you're very familiar with, but I think it's very important for us to remind ourselves of that. And if I move on and look at the summary of the Zimbabwe PMTCT program achievements and summaries, again, as I said, you will get a lot of details, which I'm actually not going to talk about here in our posters on Wednesday, and also actually on Tuesday, we have two other posters there with lots of details. But I would like to simply say over 90% of health institutions in Zimbabwe are now providing some form of PMTCT services by the end of 2005, and integration of PMTCT services into existing MCH services has taken place. About 400,000 new NC attendees were seen in PMTCT services in Zimbabwe, again by the end of 2005, and this is cumulative. Looking also at 2005, that is. And of course, at the very end there, limited follow-up of mothers and HIV-exposed babies continues to be the main challenge of our program. Following on that, and what exactly do I mean by that, this particular table is basically comparing HIV-exposed babies followed up in 2003, 2004, and 2005 in Zimbabwe. And quite clearly, although we managed to identify several babies who were HIV exposed in 2003, 2004, and 2005, it is very clear that the numbers are not as big as we would have loved them to be. We missed a lot. It is also clear that in terms of follow-up and giving them proper care, specifically looking at cotrimoxazole prophylaxis in 2003 and 2004, it's very negligible. Certainly the numbers began to improve in 2005, and I'll touch on why it perhaps started to happen like that. And looking at the actual follow-up of the babies to be able to test them at 18 months, and of course even earlier where it's possible, again in 2003, quite negligible, very little numbers in 2005, in 2004, and the numbers seem to be increasing a little bit in 2005, but still really one of our big major challenges, if you like, in terms of being able to really identify the babies and also being able to give them care and follow them up. So you could say from that, what we have actually identified in our PMTCT program in Zimbabwe, the main challenges in identification and follow-up of the HIV-exposed babies has really been the highly mobile population. Women are seen here, but they would like to go and deliver somewhere else. They are seen here, but they would like to perhaps continue somewhere else. They're continuously moving around the country, if you like. And also, one of the other challenges, we did not have a standardized identification and tracking system when our program actually went to scale in 2001. And we continue struggling with that challenge as we're moving with the program and trying to say, how can we actually do that? And finally, limited human and financial resources for active follow-up. I know in Cameroon, he was actually talking of them going out and physically trying to find these women and so on. One way of actually doing it, trying to identify the babies and then following up. But I think when you have limited resources in terms of human capacity, financial, you can see it's very, very problematic, and you might actually not even be able to do much at all. So what is it that we've done in Zimbabwe to try and address some of these challenges? Addressing challenges of the identification, follow-up of HIV-exposed babies, making PMTCT services widely available. If you remember at the beginning, I said over 90% of health institutions are now actually offering PMTCT services. That in itself has actually helped us in terms of us being able to identify babies. They might be delivered here, we identify them there, but we lose them if we don't have a service elsewhere. But because we're now throughout the country, we're still able to keep track, if you like, because if they go to this other place, the services are still very much there. Introduction of innovative ways of addressing human capacity gaps for follow-up and for counseling has actually been one of the areas that we've taken on in Zimbabwe to try and actually address some of the challenges of being able to identify and follow-up babies. Specifically, we've introduced a primary care counselor, a new cadre in our health institutions, which is a cadre who is actually dedicated to doing counseling and testing, a cadre who is also actually linking our mothers with the community so that we're able to follow them up in the community and be able to identify them and actually get them back to the health institutions for further care and so on. But at the bottom there, I've got integration and standardization of tracking system for care and follow-up. This is the area perhaps I'm going to give a little more detail in terms of what it is that we've actually done in Zimbabwe to make that a reality. So introduction of a standardized tracking system to identify and follow up babies in Zimbabwe. First of all, this particular system is really integrated into the monitoring system for our ANC, for the comprehensive care of mothers and babies coming to ANC. It is also a modification of existing tools, not just integrating and coming up with new tools, but specifically looking at the tools that are already there. And here we're looking at the delivery, the ANC, the delivery, and the postnatal register that were already in place before the PMTCT era came on board, looking at those and modifying them to put in indicators there that we're able to identify women as they're coming. In other words, she comes to this particular clinic. If she goes to another clinic, she can still be a part of that program and continue receiving care and follow-up. And at the bottom there, handheld mother's ANC and postnatal cards, as well as a handheld child health card. These are very famous cards that everybody knows about that are used in a lot of places, and I know Dr. Stringer talked about it, where you're saying mothers have handheld cards and they move around with them. In Zimbabwe, we've looked at that, and we've struggled with it for quite a bit of time from 2000 and towards the end of 2002-03 to say, what is it that we can do to be able to say the mother gets a card that she's always been receiving when she delivers, but we now have indicators, we now have issues of PMTCT, so that wherever she goes in our program, national program, which has expanded throughout the whole country, wherever she goes, if she's holding her card, she's able to be identified, she's able to be given the care, and her baby, of course, is also able to actually get the care and follow-up that it requires. So if I go into a little bit of detail about the specifically child health card and what we have done, modification of the handheld child health card. Before this card was modified, it was used by health workers to provide basic care, routine immunization, EPI, monitoring of growth and development of all the babies. So as you can see, this tool, it was very important for us to use it because everybody's familiar with it, and they really have, actually, mothers are known to really keep it safe in their bags. And when they present to the clinic, for whatever reason, they bring it out. And we thought this was really a great time for us to actually maximize and use that. After the modification of our card, the card now provides basic care as usual for all the babies, and I'm emphasizing all the babies. And again, it was very important for us to look at that and say, we don't want to say this is a card for PMTCT because you're stigmatizing. And mothers may then begin to hide the card, and then, of course, you don't use it. So this continues to be a card for all the babies that are coming to the clinic. And, of course, it now includes identification of HIV-exposed babies for follow-up and, of course, for further care and treatment of that particular child. And, again, it's for all the babies. Yes, for HIV-exposed babies, but please note, the HIV... the children who are not HIV exposed still are at risk because the mothers can become HIV positive when they are breastfeeding. Therefore, this particular child will certainly become exposed at some point, even though when we identified the baby at birth, it was not exposed. So very, very important that we really took this card and said it's for all the babies, but quite clearly we're looking more and emphasizing on the HIV exposed baby. Now, I don't know if I will be able to use this technology here. Yeah, I can. All right. This particular slide is showing you the child handheld health card for Zimbabwe 2005. This is the card we've always had. It had this panel, that panel, this panel, and what we've added is this panel right here. This is the panel we are calling the care panel, if you like. Not for you to squint and try and get the details because I'll show you. And on the other side of the card, it has always been like that, but and it has also always have this particular box there, the red, with the at-risk factors. We've also added something about mother-to-child transmission, specifically to be able to identify those babies who need further follow-up. So if I go into the details of some of the issues that we've actually integrated or modified or changed on this card that we've always had, the front of the card has in the past had a woman who was breastfeeding. We thought it is very important for us, in order for us to be able to identify that child, the partner or the father has got to be greatly involved. And we thought, someone mentioned this somewhere a little bit earlier, saying where are the fathers and so on. We thought by including the partner there, the husband, we are actually enhancing identification of babies. The fathers will be happy to be associated with this card, and therefore will give the support to the woman to take the baby to the clinic for that further care and follow-up. And it is actually happening. In another forum, perhaps we'll talk about this, where we actually did a pilot in terms of saying, this revised child health card, are the mothers and the community accepting it? Are the health workers and so on accepting it? And lo and behold, we learned a lot. It was actually the health workers that were trying to stigmatize issues of HIV, us putting them on the card. And the community there was saying, where have you been all these years? We've been waiting for this. We want it. It's going to help us. And we're very happy. And there are also very interesting comments about the partner actually being included on this card. Very interesting, but very, very important for us because it actually helped us move on a lot. Again, on those details specifically, here we're looking at the little bits. I'm now looking at the panel which we've added issues on or information on. Follow-up schedule, infant feeding management. We added this specifically because we're saying mother-to-child transmission, it happens in three ways. And, of course, we do know when you're breastfeeding, you can still pass it on to the baby, as I mentioned earlier. So quite clearly, we need to make sure that at every follow-up time, the health workers are counseling the mothers on infant feeding. They are giving them more support on the choices that they make, and we are indeed therefore actually providing more care and follow-up, appropriate follow-up to those babies, if you like. Again, still on the details of the issues that we've actually added on, this particular slide is showing follow-up care panel on our child health card. And this is perhaps where most of the information is, where if you're looking at the very top, we now have information on whether this HIV-exposed baby has actually been given ARV prophylaxis. And here in Zimbabwe, we're using single-dose nevirapine, but we are actually looking at moving on to the more efficacious, as has come out from WHO, new guidelines. And we actually were thinking ahead and saying, if we just put single-dose nevirapine only, what happens when we change? We've made sure that we've also reflected that this particular child might have actually received something else other than just nevirapine. And then again, moving down, you can see that we now also again emphasize on the follow-up time when the baby comes for their immunizations and so on. We're also capitalizing on that in saying, has the baby received cotrimoxazole? Has it been supplied at all those visits? Has there been counseling about that? And so on. So this is the follow-up timetable we've added, and specifically adding on the cotrimoxazole prophylaxis, which is very important for HIV-exposed babies. If you move on to that additional information, we've now also added whether the parent or caregiver has been pre-test counseled. Here we're looking at the follow-up and saying these babies will now need to be tested later on at 18 months in Zimbabwe, but quite clearly even earlier where it is possible for the issues of actually giving appropriate care once you know their status. And again, moving on down there, we now also have the time the test has been done, and also specifically identifying those who are HIV positive or negative, so that we can move on and say if they are indeed negative, we no longer need to require need to continue with the cotrimoxazole. If they are indeed positive, we need more care. Do they now need to be referred to the pediatrician? Do they need treatment? And so on and so on. So this is really the detail of following up, or rather identifying babies and following them up. If you remember at the beginning, I showed you the inside of the card and there was a red box there with at-risk factors. These have always been there. The baby with less than 2 kilograms at birth, fifth child or more, multiple pregnancies, and so on and so on. But we've added MTCT, which was not there. This, again, is specifically for us to be able to identify the babies so that we can give them further care and follow them up. So, ladies and gentlemen, if I may try and summarize what I've actually just said now, we could pose a question to ourselves and say, how can we provide PMTCT services? Or can we say how Zimbabwe has done it and ensure identification and follow-up of HIV-exposed children for further follow-up? I think what we've done is really answering that question. We can say integration of PMTCT services into existing health systems is very key to that, guided by a comprehensive PMTCT and pediatric HIV AIDS care strategy, whether you're looking at the four-prong or even a more detailed strategy that each nation is actually supposed to have, is very critical for you to be able to do that. And once you've actually done that, we can say also, in order for us to really be able to identify them, it is very important that you have your services throughout the country. It is not good enough to just have a pilot in a few areas and so on, because we will not be able to identify as many babies as possible, and hence you will not be able to provide them with the care that they do deserve. It is therefore also important, if you're looking at that and saying, in order for you to be able to identify them in all those various areas, geographic areas, you do need to make sure that your ANC registers, your delivery registers, and specifically handheld records are modified so that when the woman and the child move on to another place, they're able to be identified, and then of course you're able to provide the service that they do require. And with those two in all locations in the country, handheld records which are actually identifying the babies, you can then really be able to identify the babies for that follow-up and care, and of course you're able to follow them throughout the country if you like. Still again, with that handheld card, you can then also be able to say wherever the child presents, they are delivered here in Chitungwiza, they report some other center and so on. With that handheld card that is actually identifying the baby, you are now able to actually go further, provide care, test them, and make sure you are aware of their status, so that with that, you are able to actually, together with the mother, of course, because we do know that just looking at the baby alone in isolation is not good enough. Research and studies have actually shown that where the mother is not there, even if you have an HIV negative baby, their chances of survival are not as good as those of a child who still has a mother there. So it is very important for us to say, in order for us to be able to identify, follow up the babies, give them appropriate care, we need the mother to be there as well. And together, the two being identified, we're able to follow up and give care of those HIV-exposed babies with the mother and the family. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank you and acknowledge Elizabeth Glazer, Pediatric AIDS Foundation, for actually helping us a lot, supports in terms of the process we've actually gone through, modifying our child health card, but most importantly, actually supporting the whole national program. And of course, there are lots of other organizations through our PMTCT Partnership Forum, and those who've actually supported this particular session. I think from me, I would like to say thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you.
Are people thinking about questions? Please feel free to go to the microphones while we get ourselves organized up here. Surely there will be questions after all of this information. Are we ready? And could you identify yourself, and if you wish to address it to a specific speaker, please do so.
Nancy Miller, and I'm a midwife working with the Clinton Foundation in Lesotho in very rural area. And I would like to ask Dr. T from the Cameroon about if he could talk a little bit more about the kind of training and involvement of traditional birth attendants in PMTCT activities. Lesotho is also a very rural area, and most of the babies there are born at home, and we're looking at trying to how to get effective PMTCT out in that situation.
Thank you. Professor T.
You're free.
I think what you need to do with TBAs is training. You need to bring them in, train them on how to dispense nevirapine to the babies, to the mothers when they come to the clinic, because it is simple to offer. But the key thing here is you should have a rapid test. And we were first using OraQuick, and now we are using Determine. They are able to do that. They're able to use that. So I don't know what rapid test you have in your own country, because you can teach them to perform the rapid tests right in the clinics when the mothers come, and be able to also give them the nevirapine with instructions on when to take. But there should also be supervisors that come around from time to time on a monthly basis to see what they are doing, what these TBAs are doing. Supervision is very, very important. Recently, we went around to evaluate to see what they are doing, and we notice that they are doing even much better than we thought they were doing. Their registers are wonderful, and their follow-up of the mothers too is also very, very good. So I think it's a thing you can do in Lesotho just as we are doing in Cameroon if you can train them well.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you very much for your wonderful presentations. I take a keen interest in the presentation from India, especially the point about there's a counseling on breastfeeding as well. So in resource-poor, resource-limited areas, I understand that it is difficult to, for example, formula feed where there's no clean water or availability of formula. And in this case, the breastfeeding counseling comes in very important, because the exclusivity of it is one of the way where we can prevent HIV transmission. I'm wondering if this is also practiced in other sites, as in Cameroon and Zambia and Zimbabwe as well.
You're asking if exclusive breastfeeding is practiced in the other locations?
Breastfeeding practices. Yeah.
If I heard you correctly, yes, exclusive. Can I do this one? exclusive breastfeeding counseling is very much one of the reasons why we've actually introduced a primary care counselor, a cadre who is specifically there for counseling only, who is not a nurse, who is drawn into all those other clinical activities, is specifically to try and address that issue and say we do need a lot of counseling on infant feeding, on exclusive breastfeeding, and very much other issues as well. Yes.
In Cameroon, we do that too. And also, those who will choose not to breastfeed, we also tell them what to do. But exclusive breastfeeding is still encouraged a lot in our programs in Cameroon.
Dr. Ndwadi.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, to congratulate you all for your excellent programs and being able to achieve what it's been very difficult in many other sites. Now, I just have one question to any of the panel members. We are moving towards the use of heart for care of the mother. I have very little experience with it, but the little experience I've had is that we've had remarkably serious immune reconstitution syndromes in women who we are starting heart during pregnancy. This is in the context of clinical trials. It usually sets in maybe like 8 to 12 weeks after initiating therapy, and I work in a tertiary level facility, and we've had to call in internists to help us manage women who are extremely ill. What's the experience in the other sites, and what are the what thoughts do people have about managing these kind of fairly serious problems in women who obviously need heart for their own treatment, and who we will be treating in situations where we are not going to be having the kind of medical care you have in a tertiary institution. Is there any thought about giving shot the AZT and a single dose nevirapine and maybe TB treatment presumptively before we go on to heart in these kind of situations? I would like to have some views, particularly from people who've had a little more experience.
Thank you. Elizabeth, do you want to try that?
Sure. In clinical trials, you're monitoring much better, and so you really know what's happening with your patients. And we have not seen this so much in Lusaka. However, I'm worried that we may be missing it in patients. In MDCD Plus, we had one patient with a very severe, just one, though, of almost 200 women on therapy that had a very severe nevirapine rash, although it was stopped and she did fine. We have discussed what you mentioned in the general population in people with very low CD4 counts as a potentially starting TB therapy prior to starting heart. Now, because of all of the issues surrounding pregnant women, especially with their hemodynamic situations and if they were to go into immune reconstitution, it's not a bad idea, I think, to take each patient individually and really look at the patients with really low CD4 counts. In the patients you were enrolling in your trial, we haven't seen that many pregnant women with severely low CD4 counts. Did you have a significant number that were under 50 enrolling in your trial, or was it a special population that maybe you were taking care of?
Yeah. But the women who did have really low CD4 counts had lots of problems. Now, when you scale up on a national scale, and you have large numbers, in that group of women, those will be increasing in numbers.
Exactly.
And what we found in clinical trials, in terms of unscheduled visits, the countries had a huge number
Dr. Ndwadi just said that the women with the lowest CD4 counts had a number of problems in terms of complications of therapy, and that the unscheduled visits women were very ill. Did I repeat it correctly? Okay. Dr. Sinkala.
Thank you very much. First of all, congratulations to the wonderful presentations. What I want to do is make one or two comments. First and foremost, I think when we talk about follow-up of infants exposed to HIV,
These are children born from HIV positive mothers. I think we need to go beyond looking at those ones who might be positive. I think when you look at the transmission rate, we are talking, especially with the interventions which might be there, we may probably, transmission may be limited to 12% or even less. But just the mere exposure to HIV might have some other implications which we really do not know at this stage. And I think it will be important as we follow up the children who have been exposed. Some of the easiest things, the variables from growth monitoring can tell us quite a number of things so that we can actually start looking at much more interventions to these children who are exposed. And I think then the second one is on the infant feeding options. And again, one of the colleagues who asked the question, I feel it was not answered very successfully, and I think that's what prompted me to come here. I think in low resource settings, some of the things which we need to look at critically, and in Lusaka we are discussing this with some inputs from Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, acceptability of the choice, affordability, sustainability, and I think these issues, we need to integrate them as we are counseling the mothers. Otherwise, really, we are not really doing counseling. We are probably telling them do exclusive breastfeeding without going beyond what we are calling as the option. You may respond, or anyone can respond to that. Thank you very much.
Yes, Professor Samuel.
We used to talk about exclusive breastfeeding. We found that when the mother went home, it was the mother or the grandmother who was telling her, what are you trying to do? You know, I brought up so many kids. So now we bring in the mother and the grandmother as well for the counseling. We hope that this will make a change. We have no results as yet to tell you. But every time, I think, whenever we introduce a new concept, we need to take this whole family around to make sure that they understand. Otherwise, these are standalone programs.
I think we have one last question. I'm getting the signal from the back of the room. Yeah. One last, and then we'll be finished.
My name is Wu Sanzulu. I'm an activist from Zambia. And I want to direct my question to the last presenter. When I was following, I saw the picture of a father on the antenatal card. Do you do this? Is it fathers or rather husbands integrated in the prevention of mother-to-child transmission? And if it is, how do you do that? Because I believe when you're testing the mother, the father is not there. And when we look at limited resource areas, it's very difficult for mothers to disclose their sero status if one is found to be reactive. We don't know the reaction from the husbands. So for that to be a success, there should be the integration or possibly a collective agreement that is supposed to be reached between the two parties. So how do you do this in Zimbabwe? And secondly, there's somewhere where you show the mother that she takes the single dose of nevirapine. Don't you think to some extent that could pave way to stigma discrimination when someone looks at the card of the mother, and then that would, of course, trigger the message that this person is reactive, because it's not all the people that would accept their status, and then it's something which is very difficult for one to come face-to-face with the reality when he's told that his status is reactive.
Thank you very much. I think, in fact, when I tried to allude to it when I said we actually piloted and went out to find out from the community and the health workers whether this was the case. And we're very pleased with the results. And we had to move on and say, we've got to do it in order for the benefit of the children to receive care. If you are not able to identify them, you're not able to give them any further follow-up. But the challenge is still there. I do agree with you. And the other issue that you wanted to know was the partners. Yes, we've included them. We're trying to continue mobilizing them. It's still a challenge, but this is one way of actually addressing it, to say, you're part of it. Support your partner in terms of bringing the baby for care and support and so on. In terms of the HIV infant feeding counseling that came up later on, if I may just quickly comment on it, yes, we are actually giving comprehensive counseling and not just saying breastfeed. The whole package is talked about. On the card, it actually shows all the various options. Women are not just forced to say exclusively breastfeed. The reason we will give a lot of detail about exclusive breastfeeding is sometimes that's the only option that is available to them, but it does not mean that's what we're saying do, not at all. I think I see the back there.
Yes, they really need to have us leave. Thank you to my colleagues, and thank you to all of you.